This is the takeaway for Wednesday, May 24th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. Thank you for listening.
It is now beyond doubt that the people of Manchester and of this country have fallen victim to a callous terrorist attack, an attack that targeted some of the youngest people in our society with cold calculation.
We begin today in the aftermath of Monday's terror attack in the UK. You heard there British Prime Minister Theresa May, who announced the government had boosted the terror alert level from severe to critical yesterday, suggesting a new attack could be imminent. ISIS claimed responsibility for this latest attack, which, as you've likely heard, killed 22 people and injured dozens after a concert by singer Ariana Grande. Grande packs arenas around the world with kids, mostly girls, and in this attack, the victims included an 8-year-old. The world was horrified by the choice of targets, but in many ways, it's nothing new. Nightclubs filled with young people have been targeted in the West before, and countless children have died in Islamist attacks across the Middle East and around the world. Still, there feels like there is something new in this tactic, targeting children and teens and their parents out for a good time. Or maybe it's a logical progression in the terrorist mission to keep people from feeling safe and secure. Here to help explain the shifting tactics and talk about how we deal with them is Jessica Stern, a professor at the Pardee School of Global Studies at Boston University and co-author of ISIS, The State of Terror. Jessica, welcome.
Thank you, Todd.
Anyone of conscience, Professor, recoils from a terrorist attack targeting young people and their parents, in this case, young girls. But what does the analyst see in terms of intentions or strategy in an attack like this?
Well, I think there are two things we can say. One is that ISIS is constantly upping the ante in terms of trying to shock us. They are very good psychologically at figuring out what will be most horrifying. And the other thing we can say is that terrorists are constantly going for soft targets. That is something we've seen repeatedly with an uptick in 2015 in Europe. But in this case, they specifically targeted the exit where they actually outside the security perimeter, which was a new move as far as I know.
A new move tactically in terms of the security perimeter, metal detectors, and things like that.
Right. It was a new level of sophistication in terms of getting around security. And this is a constant cat and mouse game where we come up with new countermeasures and the terrorists find ways to get around them.
So, Jessica Stern, when we take together both the new tactics in terms of the security perimeter and the exit and the chosen target, is there a new subtext that's worth understanding here, or is it just a continuum on the horror that we've already seen?
Well, I think the obvious question is, was ISIS deliberately targeting young girls? Was this an attack on children? Was this an attack on girls? And we don't yet know whether it was a deliberate strategy to go after girls, but it certainly is a possibility.
How have terror tactics changed or even strategy? We've seen a big surge in attacks and in very deadly ones, not on a 9/11 scale, but certainly on a mass scale. Everybody remembers attacks in Orlando and Paris and Brussels and other places. And the numbers of these attacks have been on the rise.
Yes. Since 2015, there has been a big increase in attacks at soft targets. Yes, compared with the 9/11 strike, they're not especially sophisticated. And the death count is obviously less than what happened on 9/11. But I think in some ways, these kind of relatively low-level attacks at soft targets are even more horrifying because one has the feeling that the terrorists could attack anytime, anywhere, even our children.
And what can we draw from the large increase in the frequency of attacks in all of these places? It seemed like there were several years of relatively few attacks. 2015 through 2016 and 17 have seen a huge uptick. What explains the increased activity?
One explanation is ISIS. ISIS is a kind of open source jihad. Al-Qaeda was very particular about who it let into the organization, whereas ISIS will take just about anyone. And in fact, we're seeing in Europe that nearly 60% of those who have gone to join the organization have been criminals. So we see this kind of overlap between criminality and terrorism. It's a dramatic overlap.
Well, if that's 60% of people in Europe who've gone to fight with ISIS, as the war against ISIS escalates, and we can assume eventually some form of military defeat, many of those 60%, if they're not killed on the battlefield, are going to come back home.
That's right. And that's a big worry. There are about 4,500 foreign fighters that have gone to join ISIS. The numbers vary, but it's approximately that. And we think that many of them will come home, some of them to carry out a jihad at home. Some of them will want to reintegrate. And this is the challenge for us. On the one hand, we'd love to be able to use those who are disgruntled, who are unhappy about what they saw. And certainly there are Europeans who are very unhappy about what they witnessed when they joined the so-called five-star jihad and found that it was very different from how it was advertised. We'd like to be able to have them talk about what it's really like in Syria and Iraq to be a member of this terrible organization. On the other hand, there is the risk that they actually want to perpetrate a so-called jihad at home. Some will presumably claim to have changed their mind and will want to carry out a jihad. So it poses a challenge for law enforcement and for those of us who would like to use those returnees as part of a countering violent extremism effort.
If I'm a policymaker, Jessica Stern, I listen to what you're saying, but it's hard for me, if I'm responsible for the well-being of my constituents, for the population, to say, okay, well, some of these people might be assets. We'll give them a chance, or we'll follow them around and we won't just jail them or kill them.
That's right. And certainly anybody who committed a crime will be imprisoned. But there are people who went as, for example, jihadi wives and didn't get involved in violence, who would very much like to be reintegrated.
Jessica, let's talk about how we react to attacks like the one in Manchester, the psychological and social impact of terror. People are writing about it again, about how we react to these horrors. And that was the case after attacks in 2001 and 2005. Terrorists don't have the number or the firepower to hurt our countries. Their only hope is fear and overreaction. It seems like we're still talking about this 15 or 16 years later, how we should react to attacks like this. Have we evolved in our ability to deal with this kind of violence?
I think this is a very hard problem. I think we're wired to respond to this kind of evil with a kind of spiritual dread. And it's very hard to be rational in the face of that dread. I mean, we can say statistically that this is a very small threat compared with many others that societies face. In the United States, for example, gun violence is a much bigger threat than terrorism. But it feels really different because it's not an accident. It's something we absolutely can't control. It feels utterly random. And it feels evil. And I think that is the crux of the matter. We're confronting something truly evil, and it's hard not to be emotional about it.
Well, how are our leaders doing? Have their reactions changed for the better at all?
I think that we're tempted in times like this to lash out at any enemy. I think we do have to be careful about a strategy that involves eradicating ISIS in the territory it currently controls. The problem with a massive escalation in our military response to ISIS in Iraq and Syria is that it puts us at risk of inadvertently spreading the organization beyond that territory. And this is something I think we need to factor in to our calculations. Are we actually pushing ISIS into Jordan? Are we pushing ISIS into Lebanon? Are we inadvertently making Western targets more attractive as a result of this massive military campaign to eradicate ISIS in Iraq and Syria?
Then how do you sell Americans who are understandably and rightfully horrified by what they're seeing in Manchester and other places, sell them on the idea that total revenge, total eradication may not be the answer? Or do you not sell them on it and just have the policymakers make that a policy in secret?
You know, I think the idea of total eradication is great if we could pull it off. The problem is, while we might be able to defeat them militarily where they are right now, that doesn't mean total eradication. That's the problem. This is an ideology. It's an idea. It's spreading around the world. And in fact, if they're in Iraq and Syria, they are fighting many other terrorist groups. Often the terrorists, we think that we're their most important enemy, but their most important enemy from their perspective is often other terrorist groups that they're competing with for personnel, for money, for attention.
Professor Jessica Stern, thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Todd.
Jessica Stern is professor at the Pardee School of Global Studies at Boston University, also co-author of ISIS, The State of Terror.
You got to remember, this is Montana. People have an independent, cowboy-type attitude.
Last week, I took a trip to a state that doesn't get a lot of national press and probably doesn't want much, but it still has a lot of stories that connect it with the country. Montana is one of the states that expanded Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act back in late 2015. Now, over 77,000 low-income people have access to health care that they didn't have before, and more than 11,000 of those are Native Americans. In a state with a tiny population, those numbers are huge. But now, those Montanans are dealing with an unknown just like in other states. What happens if debates in Washington over repealing the Affordable Care Act mean that these new health care benefits go away?
Well, I think the most important thing is the health disparities that are found among American Indians in Montana when you compare us to white Montanans.
And that is
Anna Whiting Sorrell. I'm the Director of Operations for the Confederated Salish and Kootenai Tribal Health Department.
I met Anna in St. Ignatius on the Flathead Indian Reservation in northwest Montana.
So here is when you walk into the center, the facility. So this is where healthcare actually, we're trying to get healthcare.
Before she worked for the tribe, Whiting Sorrell was the head of the Montana Department of Health and Human Services, and she was the first Native American person to ever hold that job. Now she's helping lead the team on the Flathead Reservation, who are doing something revolutionary in Montana. The tribe has opted completely out of the Indian Health Service. Whiting Sorrell calls it a broken system, antiquated and underfunded. And in its place, they've set up a self-contained and self-owned health network. It has a comprehensive clinic in St. Ignatius and six other satellite clinics around the reservation. And that move away from the Indian Health Service means many tribal members use Medicaid. Whiting Sorrell estimates 1,000 adult tribal members have gotten new coverage under the Medicaid expansion, and she hopes the new clinics and the new benefits will help address the large health disparities between Natives and white Montanans.
So I, as an Indian woman, can expect to die at 64, whereas a non-Native woman, it's 84. So what that means is it's a generation younger. We die for different reasons, higher rates of diabetes, of cancer, of heart disease, accidents, just all of those issues.
How important has the expansion that's recently come to Montana under the ACA been to these people who come through your doors?
It's absolutely essential on two different levels. Montana's always had a comprehensive array of services under the Medicaid program, but it had a very limited eligibility. When it was able to be expanded to adults, that allowed there to be health care delivered to, here in our community, 1,000 adults are now covered. 1,000 in Lake County have now gained access to health care that didn't have it. in addition to actually being able to get health care in our facility here, if you come here and you get your service here and you're Medicaid eligible, we can bill the state. And then that money that we get when we bill can be reinvested back into providing more services.
The unavoidable next question is, what happens here if expansion goes away?
You know, I'm pretty firm in my belief that we are going to fight to keep our health care. But if for some reason those 1,000 people end up losing their health care, they will get sick.
The expansion really allowed more families to qualify for services that they weren't able to before the expansion came.
That is Durand Bear Medicine.
And I am the clinical coordinator here for the Southern Pagan School Health and Wellness Program.
Durand is part of the Blackfeet Nation. Tribal members use the Indian Health Service, but the tribe wanted alternatives. Durand is helping run a program that provides health services through schools, and that program relies heavily on Medicaid.
In trying to deal with our Indian Health Service and what they're up against, a lot of times people have a hard time getting into their services and their unit, which is really no fault of theirs, but I know this how the system works funding-wise. There's a lot of limitations and barriers there. And so people get frustrated with that. And then they hate to sit up there for hours waiting to get help in the ER. For sometimes up to 6 to 10 hours they may wait, sometimes longer. Or have to wake up every morning at 5:30, 6 o'clock to get up to dental, to wait for an appointment, or to get in to see a provider. And so it was our goal here with this community-based, school-based clinic to make it more accessible and affordable, but try to help alleviate some of that weight that IHS has been carrying for years.
So school-based healthcare, does that mean school-based just for kids, or does that mean putting a clinic in a school that their parents can come to as well and other members of the community can come, but you're placing it where the school is? Walk me through that a little bit.
The idea for this clinic is we wanted to come in and we wanted to make it accessible for the kids, primarily K through 12. But we started to deliver services to kids at the Head Start level and even some babies that we've seen this year.
Whether in Indian country or outside of it, nearly everyone I talked to in Montana said the expanded access that comes with Medicaid has meant more preventative care. They say that's a key factor in keeping low-income people out of the hospital and out of debt.
You got to remember, this is Montana.
Meet Louis King. He's president and CEO of Benefis Teton Medical Center in the tiny town of Shodo, Montana, population 1,700.
People have an independent, cowboy-type attitude. And that attitude wants to take care of yourself, and they don't want to incur debt. So a lot of times what they would do is they would wait and see if their health improved, which if it didn't, 9 times out of 10, they're going to end up in the ER, which is the costliest option.
King told me that small rural hospitals need Medicaid dollars to stay open. But he also points out that these small clinics are a major source of jobs for rural towns.
A critical access hospital is a very special type hospital. We don't do procedures. We don't do operations. We don't even do OB now. What we mainly do is have long-term care for residents of the town and an emergency room along with PT, OT, and a lab. Now, you have to understand, not only from a healthcare perspective are we important to the community, but we're also very important to the community from an economic perspective, because there's 50 critical access hospitals in the state of Montana, and they are the backbone of the economic engines that keep these towns solvent.
Money and economics hit home at the administrative level, but they do for patients, too.
My name is Holly Block, and I live in Kalispell, Montana, and I'm a caregiver.
Holly Block has serious health issues, but she only works part-time because she spends most of her time caring for her elderly mother. She got coverage when Montana expanded Medicaid, and she says it's helping keep her from financial ruin. But Block also says that for her, not having Medicaid could be a question of life or death.
About 8 years ago, I was diagnosed with a lung disorder called sarcoidosis. A few months after that, I was diagnosed with kidney failure, which has progressed to stage 5. And because of the autoimmune lung disorder and the kidney failure, it makes it very difficult to do any kind of full-time work, any kind of work at all. And in March, I had to have a blood transfusion because of it.
And you're close to the point where you're going to be able to have a kidney transplant now, right?
Correct.
What does a kidney transplant mean to you, to your well-being? How important is that?
It's my life. I mean, without it, I'm, you know, it's like life and death for me. It's like Russian roulette. Without it, there's a 50-50 chance that I might make it and I might not. And with it, you know, it's a future of being able to have a somewhat normal life.
Back in January, mm-hmm. when you got on Medicaid, were you ineligible for it before? Did you not qualify before and now you qualify? How did that work?
Well, before here, to have Medicaid, you either had to be pregnant or have kids under a certain age. Well, I was neither or, so I didn't qualify for it. And now I do because of the new healthcare expansion. The fact that I have health insurance to be able to go to my specialty doctors when before I didn't. I have health insurance to cover me when I need to go in and have these shots to boost up my red blood count cells that I wouldn't have had coverage for before. I mean, it's been a lifesaver for me, and it's been a lifesaver for many people here.
Congress is in the middle of a debate over how to repeal the Affordable Care Act. Many governors are asking Republican leaders in Washington to think twice before repealing the parts of the law that pay for states like Montana to expand Medicaid. It's got a lot of Montanans and the people who care for them watching and wondering about their future. This is The Takeaway. There are over 3,000 counties in the United States, and every year, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation puts out county health rankings. They're a kind of mosaic snapshot of public health in this country. This year's report includes a new metric, a look at our nation's disconnected youth. These are young people between 16 and 24 who are neither working nor in school. And in 2015, there were about 4.9 million disconnected youth. That's about 1 in 8, not in school or working. Today and tomorrow, we're going to look at who these young people are and also look at some local efforts to reconnect them with their communities. We begin with Clive Belfield. He's a professor of economics at Queens College in New York. He co-authored a study in 2012 measuring the economic burden of disconnected youth. Also here, Kate Kingery. She's deputy director of community transformation at County Health Rankings and Roadmaps.
I think there are a number of factors that contribute to the disengagement of youth and young adults from school and work. What we've seen in our data set is the communities where we have higher rates of disengagement or disconnection, we've also seen lower rates of educational attainment, higher rates of unemployment, higher rates of children in poverty, higher rates of children in single-parent households, and higher rates of teen birth.
Clive Belfield, is disconnected youth a problem that statistically you can show has gotten worse? And if so, what are the causes?
So we think it has gotten worse mostly because the labor force participation rate of disconnected youth, we like to call them opportunity youth, that labor force participation rate has been going down year on year dramatically since 2000. It used to be about half of teenagers could get a job. Now it's about a third. Now some of them are going to college, but a lot of them have stopped looking for work or are simply going to college because they can't find work, or they've just dropped out of the economic system.
And Clive, from your point of view, is that lousy economy? I mean, is this a case of not as many low-end jobs that young people would want to take at the burger stand or the amusement park? Or is it something much deeper and more systemic?
So it's certainly economic forces are driving this. Low-wage work has stayed very low-wage, so working is barely going to get you above the poverty level. School preparation has not improved in the last decade or so. So these students are not well prepared for the labor market. And then there's another factor, which is the Great Recession, which drove a lot of baby boomers back into the labor market. And so the end of the labor market, the retirees, are not retiring as fast, so there aren't as many freed up jobs further down the line. So it's both things are happening at the same time. The poor economy is reducing the incentive to get skills, which is making for fewer productive workers.
Kate Kingery, anytime there is social disengagement, there is crime, there are health problems, there are welfare problems. Can you connect the phenomenon of disconnected youth to many of the other things that we already know about social disengagement?
Well, I think young people make choices based on the opportunities they have available. With this population, we don't see them as drivers of some of the social ills. We see them as having experienced many of the social ills. Anecdotally, we project that among the population that we identify as disconnected or opportunity youth, that there's probably also high rates of homelessness, involvement in the child welfare system, some involvement in the juvenile justice system, early parenting, and likely having grown up in poverty.
You know, Clive, it's one thing to talk about disconnected youth, and 5 million is a staggering number. What kind of adult does a disconnected youth become? I think that's the key question.
I agree. What we looked at was what are we spending now to try to ameliorate this, to try to make it better right now for the teenagers. But then we realized, what are the consequences when these teenagers and youth become full adults after 25? And that consequence of not being successful in helping opportunity youth, that consequence is enormous. These are students who are repeatedly being affected by this. And so it's not just a one-year deal. The students, opportunity youth, are being subjected to these economic forces every year from age 16 to 24. And when you cumulatively add that up, their adult prospects are significantly diminished.
Well, I want to thank you both for being here. Kate Kingery, Deputy Director of Community Transformation at County Health Rankings and Roadmaps, a collaboration between Robert Wood Johnson and the University of Wisconsin, and also Clive Belfield, Professor in the Department of Economics at Queens College. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And our look now takes us to Chicago. Remember, these are 16 to 24-year-olds, both out of school and not working. And in Chicago, there are nearly 60,000 of them. The city is mounting a campaign to reach out to what many there call opportunity youth with a public-private partnership. It's called Thrive Chicago. The idea here is to connect 10,000 of these young adults with education or training, or to put them on a new path. Here to tell us about Chicago's efforts is Brandis Friedman. She covers education with WTTW's Chicago Tonight. Brandis, welcome.
Thank you.
Why is this such a big problem in Chicago?
I think a number of things, Todd. Some folks will point to the education system in the city of Chicago. Everybody knows about Chicago's violence problem, so that contributes. So some of them end up involved in the criminal justice system, but some of the folks that I spoke with who are experts who are working on this problem in Chicago say that actually only about 2,000 of the city's 58,000 disconnected youth are actually criminal justice involved. There are other problems that are contributing. Maybe they are young moms and they have child care situations and it is hard for them to get to work or get to school. Maybe they are homeless, or maybe they have families who are criminal justice involved. So I think a number of different factors contribute to these young people not being working and not being in school.
And so it sounds like for the people trying to intervene here, and there are lots of interventions, some big ones in Chicago, the real key might be to get into those schools and try to not only keep kids in school, obviously, but sweep them up at a place where they're centralized before they can become disconnected like this.
Absolutely. And I think that is what the city of Chicago is trying to do with this latest effort. They're calling it the 10,000 Reconnected Campaign. It comes through an organization called Thrive Chicago. And so the goal is to sort of get together a lot of these organizations that are working on this and to serve as a clearinghouse to find out which organizations are doing what kind of work, how many youth are they serving, how long are they able to help them, and also to get them to share some best practices. And then the intent is to direct them to corporate partners who have agreed to hire these people, these young people, through internships and through apprenticeships, and with the goal of course, getting them back to jobs.
You've been talking to several of the young people around Chicago who've had some of this initial reaction with Thrive Chicago. What'd you find out?
That's right. I met a couple of pretty impressive young men. One of them is Avery Sterling, and we found him at one of the nonprofits that will be working on this campaign. It's called Children's Home and Aid. And, you know, he admits to kind of like, you know, getting in trouble as a younger person, but now he is working as a mentor and a program coordinator helping some younger people. And he kind of explains a little bit about his journey from where, you know, where he started to where he is today.
Hustling. I was selling drugs, trying to make money. I have a four-year-old daughter, so I was a young father, and I needed to make money to provide for my child. And it was a flyer on the ground that said jobs for ex-offenders, and I picked it up and called the number. I don't like my job. I love my job. I feel like I'm making a difference in my community. I feel like I'm making a difference in my youth lives, and I know how much of a difference was made in my own. We need people to invest in the community. We need community leaders to become community leaders. Like, it takes a village to raise a child. We need that village back.
Brandis, Avery sounds like the kind of young person who was getting into trouble but was just waiting to be shown a door to another place, and he was able to walk through it.
That's right. And it sounds like, you know, we meet a lot of young men like that. And I've heard stories across the city of other folks doing similar work, trying to reach out to young men and young women and help them find some direction. And a lot of them, you know, they need to work. You know, many of them come from low-income homes, and so they need jobs. And one of the young men that Avery works with, he's 18 years old. His name is Lewis Blake. He had some problems at home. He found this organization. You know, they're helping him work through some of those problems. But he knows that there are other people like him who just need a little more help.
I was always fighting somebody or something. I had got kicked out of home by my parents, and then I had called the hotline. They had a hotline back then, and this was like 2 years ago, so I've been with the company for 2 years. I want to be an engineer. I like math and science, and I like working with my hands. We was talking about updating my resume, adding my new experiences onto my old resume, so I can update it. They taught me everything here. My first resume that I made was here. Like, the mentoring program, it should be opened up for, like, we should expand. Like, it should be more, because there's a lot of more people out there that was like me that was probably kicked out, or they might have different situations, might not have no one to turn to.
Now, Lewis Blake is 18. He's in an internship. What's he doing now?
So he is working part-time for Children's Home and Aid. It's kind of cute. He actually works with the children of parents, young parents, who are there at Children's Home and Aid at one of their local community centers, who are there to get their classes or whatever help they need. But he graduates from high school in June. He says he wants to be an engineer, as you just heard him say. And so I think his intent is to hopefully get into a 2-year college, if not a 4-year school, once he graduates.
Public-private partnership at Thrive Chicago. The corporations are ponying up some money, and that's great. Great PR for them, to be honest. What's the city doing? What's the state doing?
What the city is doing is they are kind of the main force behind this, because Thrive Chicago was actually incubated in the mayor's office before they moved out to be its own nonprofit. And so it is kind of like the driving effort. But this is for now, a 3-year program. So I think they might have to prove that they have got some success. I think we're all probably hopeful that they can show some progress and be able to keep it going, maybe adding more, because as we discussed, you know, we're talking about 58,000 young people today. Will there be more, you know, in a few months, in a few years? So I think they have to keep it going if they're doing it right.
A 3-year project for tens of thousands of disconnected youth in Chicago, and a 3-year assignment for Brandis Friedman, who's following up on the city's efforts to coordinate disconnected youth and get them connected all across the city. Brandis Friedman, Chicago Tonight correspondent, WTTW. Thanks for talking to me.
My pleasure. Thanks, Todd.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. You're listening to the papal anthem there because Pope Francis met with President Donald Trump earlier today in the Pope's library at the Vatican. There was a photo op which, depending on who was running the pictures, featured either a smiling Pope or a stone-faced one as he stood with the First Family. It seemed to a lot of people that Francis was trying to project a mood of concern or even disapproval as he faced President Trump. We may never know exactly what words passed between the Jesuit Pope and the populist president, unless, of course, those conversations leak like so many others have recently. But this Pope does have a reputation for wading into politics. Francis speaks forcefully on behalf of refugees, while President Trump has advocated banning some refugees from the United States. The Pope criticized the president's proposed border wall, and in return, during the campaign, Donald Trump called the Pope disgraceful, following a comment by Francis that seemed to imply that Donald Trump was not a Christian because of his anti-immigrant positions. But there are more than 80 million Catholics in the United States, and exit polls suggest that Donald Trump won 52% of the Catholic vote over Hillary Clinton in 2016. Later polling suggested the split may have been even closer than that. John Gehring is here. He's Catholic Program Director at Faith in Public Life. He's author of The Francis Effect, A Radical Pope's Challenge to the American Catholic Church. John Gehring, welcome.
Great to be with you.
Put yourself, if you don't mind, in that private room with just Pope Francis, Donald Trump. What do you imagine they talked about.
Well, it would have been fascinating to be there and be a fly on the wall. We don't know, as you noted, exactly what they talked about. I imagine there was some effort to find common ground to repair what is clearly a frosty, if you will, relationship. And so I think, you know, these meetings tend to be fairly formal. The Vatican communique that came out afterwards talked about a cordial meeting and the interest to find common ground on things like healthcare, education, care for immigrants. There is an exchange of gifts. Pope Francis gave Donald Trump a copy of his encyclical Laudato Si, which focuses on the need to care for our environment and talks about climate change as one of the most profound moral issues of our time. And this is at a point where, you know, President Trump is deciding whether to stay in the Paris climate agreement, keep the United States. So I hope he does read it.
And you spend a great deal of time looking at and interpreting Pope Francis, I know. So you're an expert. Did you detect the intention of disapproval in the way the Pope carried himself during the photo op in front of the cameras?
I don't think so. I wouldn't read too much into that. By all accounts, you know, after the meeting, he had a more jovial disposition. I don't think so. I think, you know, the Pope and President Trump were probably sizing each other up a bit. And as you noted, and we've talked about, they've had a very tense public exchange, not directly from the Pope's point of view. He doesn't mention Donald Trump's name. But as you referenced earlier, he's been very critical of the president's views on immigration, refugees, other issues. So the United States has an interest and the Vatican has an interest in having a good relationship. And I think this is going to be an awkward few years, but I think they did try to repair their relationship. And it's important for the Vatican and the United States to work together on a range of issues.
So let's talk about American Catholics. It can be a mistake to divine the political positions of Catholics, historically a very diverse voting bloc. But do we have any insights, you know, just after the first 100 days, I guess we're around 120 now, about how American Catholics are digesting the Trump phenomenon?
Well, I think when you talk about American Catholics, Catholics are not monolithic, obviously, right? So when you're talking about American Catholics, Latino Catholics did not vote in high percentages for Donald Trump. White Catholics did. I think like much of the country, Catholics are very divided about this president and this administration. I think, you know, I covered a conference recently of influential conservative Catholics at the Trump Hotel here in D.C., and they were sort of cheering this administration on issues like abortion, same-sex marriage. So there was a feeling, religious liberty, there was a feeling that there's a new opening. However, I think many Catholics are, and Christians in general, or people of faith, are quite disturbed, and rightly so, about this administration's perspective on the treatment of refugees, immigrants, the environment. And I'm a progressive Catholic, and my critique of this president has less to do with left-right politics than what the gospel says about how we should judge our leaders in terms of how we treat the poor, the least, the last, and the lost. And so I think to answer your question, there's a lot of division. Personally, I'm very concerned, and I know many traditional Christians are very concerned about the direction that this administration is taking on a number of key moral issues.
Well, Catholics are the largest Christian group in America, but they're just one. And of course, there's been this curious marriage between Donald Trump and evangelicals, right, during the election and even to today, based largely on abortion and conservative judges. Most people judge this as a political calculation on the part of a fairly agnostic president when it comes to social issues like that. Call it, you know, how to get ahead in the GOP, I guess, if you like. But is there any kind of relationship that's similar, if not in words, in deed, between Donald Trump and some Catholics, or maybe the conservative Catholics that you met with in the Trump Hotel on Pennsylvania Avenue?
Well, again, yeah, I mean, I think there's a sense among some conservative Catholics that, you know, while they may find President Trump's rhetoric distasteful, there's an opening with the Supreme Court. There's an opportunity to roll back Roe v. Wade, even potentially same-sex marriage if you get a second Supreme Court justice. And so I think what I found in some of my reporting and the opportunity to talk to conservative Catholics is there's this sense that we're going to hold our nose, right? And there's things about Trump that we find distasteful, but on some issues we find agreement with him. And so I think my problem with that is the willingness to sort of look away from many traditional Christian principles about how do we treat our neighbor, how do we treat the environment. And this is what the Pope is talking about. You know, the Pope doesn't talk about climate change like a progressive sort of person who, you know, supports Greenpeace. The Pope talks about climate change from a biblical point of view, from a very traditional Christian understanding of how we are connected to the environment around us. And I think for conservative Christians and conservative Catholics more specifically, there needs to be sort of a grappling with that reality, that what this administration is doing with the budget proposal, for example, that would decimate programs that help the poor and most vulnerable, that's not Christian. That's not moral.
John Gehring is Catholic Program Director at Faith in Public Life and author of The Francis Effect, A Radical Pope's Challenge to the American Catholic Church. John Gehring, thank you for joining us, and thank you for your interpretations of the president and his relationship to this very interesting Jesuit pope.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Well, President Trump got a look at Michelangelo's frescoes in the Sistine Chapel today when he was at the Vatican. He might have also noticed those Raphael masterpieces around the Pope's offices. Well, Pope Francis knows where his priceless art is, but not everyone is so lucky. The Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston has been searching for 13 missing masterpieces for nearly 30 years. They were taken in the largest and most famous art heist in American history. Now, we're talking works by the masters, Vermeer, Rembrandt, even Edgar Degas. The museum's board of trustees now says that they're doubling the old $5 million reward to find those missing works, and that means $10 million for anyone who has good information on that pilfered art. But if you know something, get on the phone. According to the museum, that reward expires at the end of the year. You can share your art heist tips with us if you want, or you can just share your thoughts on today's show. We always want to hear from you. 877-8-MY-TAKE is the number. You can find us on Twitter at The Takeaway, and you can also find me there. I'm at Todd Zwillick. Thank you so much for listening. I am Todd Zwillick, sitting in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Oh, Cinnamon, where you gonna run to? Cinnamon, where you gonna run to?
The Takeaway is supported by Bluevine, offering businesses revolving lines of credit to help them grow and to expand. Credit lines up to $100,000. Small business credit help is available at bluevine.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.